mic, and since there's only one. And I would like Pam to start with something.
Okay.
I'll hold the mic for you.
Oh, thanks.
Then you won't have your hands full.
Thanks. Well, I was telling Lynn that I'm really curious about who you are. I'd like to take the time to find out who you are and why you're here. And maybe afterwards we'll get more of a chance to find out about that. What I'll do is I'll read the poem that was quoted in the program that I wrote. And this is going to be interesting because we just read this poem. We got together the other night, and I read this poem and came across a line in the end of this poem that made me laugh a lot. I couldn't finish reading it because the line seemed so outrageously stupid when I read it again. So I've revised this poem, and it's never been read before to anyone. So this is a new poem right now. And maybe it'll make me laugh again. Maybe it'll make you laugh. That's okay. This poem is Parowan Gap. Out with the flick of lizards and the drifting scent of new sage, we squinted up to find the writing on the wall. Silence seeped into our deepest spaces, muffling the echo of your truck door slam. The gravel crunched below our feet, the brief, insistent insect hum. Through this liquid silence, we stared upward while grass tassels nodded at our knees. This strange rock gateway towered up, marking narrow passage between desert and more desert, jammed with high mystery. Loops and spirals, snakes 300 times crossed over, circle bodies, stick arms holding what? In the brightness of the morning, our mute yearnings drew us dreamlike into ancient mystery. As a wave swings back into the oneness of the ocean, we were swallowed up into the silence of those writings. I surrendered language. Your eyes became clear windows into wind. My face became as seamless as a slick rock wall. Out there, my body stretched, warm and smooth as sand, and you were four directions, circling the gateway, creating the mystery, becoming the air. Together, we longed always for your lightness. We accepted my tribe's taloned touch. And with our eyes locked into ancient knowledge, there we found translations hidden deep within. Desert varnish shines hard on the muscles in your back. And even now, our reptile fingers skim and linger over writing in each other we pretend we do not read. Out there with the fragrance of new sage, we recognize the trust that holds each mystery, as far beyond our little figuring as the ruined hush of chipped rock in the sand.
That is a new poem.
That's a new poem.
Yeah.
It's different. Oh, thank you. You're up.
Like, what's next? Me.
May I hold the microphone for you, too?
Sure. Should I read this one?
Yeah.
Okay. This is called An Attempt at a Last Will and Testament. Excavating meaning from my front room, old phone and power bills that I always pay without sending them back, the little perforated payment section, junk mail, old birthday and Christmas cards, wads of pocket paper discharged onto the coffee or kitchen table, slips of paper with the phone numbers of completely forgotten women. I haven't eaten dinner off that dinner table in a year. Piles of little piles. There may be a placemat of exotic design and material under all of this somewhere. Well, when I die, set my body or lash my body upright on my bicycle, make a huge glorious pile of all my books and papers around me and set me alight. Oh, God, I forgot we don't believe in cremation, do we? Except in certain countries where it's required by law. I guess I would look more than a little bit silly in my temple robe sitting on a bike. On second thought, calling the the Relief Society, bury me in a mahogany box, me in my full Mormon temple burial regalia, holding my Martin guitar and a harp in my shirt breast pocket. And I'm as ready as any man can be.
Well, I'm going to try to stay with the theme that Pam said, if I can find it. Woo! And I want to read a wilderness poem as well about an experience on Stansbury Island that I had in 1988. If you'll remember, there was a wonderful full moon eclipse. Oh, you're holding that. Thank you. In that year. And I went out to Stansbury Island to see it, which is a magnificent place, to watch the moon rise over the water, and coincidentally ended up conceiving my last child there. And it really wasn't coincidental at all, because I think that child had no choice but to dive in that particular night. It was also propitious, you know, for him. But I have this epigraph that I begin the poem with, because that night there were some things that happened that I can't really explain. I heard, like an old spirit, there are many petroglyphs and stages of petroglyphs going up the mountain. And I was in a place called, I call it the altar site. And I heard this sound coming toward me all night, just like a voice in another language, the language of the people who had peppered the island with those glyphs. And then in my dream, my partner was talking back to this person, and I believe this person was my child. The Arabic parable that I begin this poem called Eclipse on Stansbury Island with says, "When the angel of God approaches you, it is terrible. When he reaches you, it is bliss. We are in a landscape beyond our knowing. We must transform, shapeshifters among presences at once fierce and receiving. A citrine eye opens slowly above Stansbury Peak. To evoke our dream in this place, we breathe smoke under rocks, offer blue corn and anticipation. Listen. A droning, harmonic voice drifts like smoke toward us all night. The spectral language of this ancient one is etched on the boulders that pepper the island's promontories. It is only the gesture we grasp. Awakened in the night to his call, we see a moon notched by a third over us. It fades and swells again, opened. As it sinks in the Newfoundland cliffs, first light scatters its diffuse breath. With seed in our belly, we surrender. Day begins quickly. Eagles circle. There is no water here. We find shelter in the recess of boulders inscribed with faint bison, meanders, deer with a perfect jawline and complete rack. Within this cavern's chill sanctuary, we are two dark berries, fertile with foreign seed, reluctant to leave this refuge for the affront of midday sun, brittle grasses, and the dusty ride homeward. The old one has not come this far. We will find him as we sort dusts collected in our clothes, our hair, dusts fallen from the gash in the moon, in seeds caught in our cuffs that we will plant and tend as they break open and whirl toward the sky."
That poem and the title of it remind me of two Mae Swenson poems. One is called Fire Island. The other one is called Eclipse Morning. And, boy, I I like it. When you read it the other night, I liked it, but really got it today. We've had two outdoor poems, one indoor poem. I have very few outdoor poems, so it's time to read an outdoor poem again. This is called Confluence, and maybe has some of the only ascertained in retrospect some of the confluence of something spiritual, something sensual. Strange vibrations east of coal country. Black sky dusted with filmy cirro nebula. Train rumbling on a trestle high above the green, whistling the high, lonesome sound of legend. Highest water in a decade, but rivers calmed tonight, languid, lapping in a little cove. Noses streaked with sunblock, bodies with skin so soft, hair silted with residue of a day on the water, where children on the verge of adolescence, adults on the edge of longing. Away from the other tents, our black, white, and yellow is pitched near the nightlight of the ladies' room. Under the cottonwood, Coke machine's a shining totem with liquid logos, little pockets of thirst pulsing under glass. Sipping squirt in the dark, I see her yellow hair, the last child in the world entering nubility. She turns briefly, we exchange greetings, neck straight, eyes resolute, she moves into the night. Next evening, safe at home, convex glass of TV screen reveals the news of two old men who earlier that day had accidentally turned their motorboat downstream, confused by rapids in a canyon they call Cataract, their craft capsized and broke apart, past the confluence of the Colorado with the green, they died.
Could I make a suggestion that mic needs to be held a little closer?
Okay.
That it is being held in some instances.
Thank you. I think we're back to you.
Should we do that?
Or anybody who wants to jump in.
Uh-huh. We all scramble for poems. Love poems? Okay. How about a round of love poems?
A round of love poems.
Ready?
What does that mean?
Are you waiting for me?
I can go ahead.
Go for it. I just think that we're ready. That's what it looks like.
Okay, this poem is called Breath, and it's one of those love poems. I think we might hear another one. It's about someone that I don't really know well enough. I only met briefly, and then he went off to his life on the coast. And so this is kind of a poem of wondering. It's for Simeon. You could be gathering the petals torn from their stems when the wind stormed through and left us all strewn, beached, like birds searching for a mother in the sea. You could be holding out your slender hand, dark, to a woman as harmonious with you as the sway and feel of fabric against your thighs as you walk toward the wanton mouth of the shore. You could be counting out rhythms in a circle of children, syncopating the familiar meter of their names. You could be giving voice past the dreams of a thousand nights to a name finally uttered. You could be at the edge, listening, with the fierce grace gifted to you, to a gesture of your own name, tentatively spoken into a landscape too vast to venture. This sinewy land, where I am rooted, exchanging breath with words that float like water, petals on water.
Yes. This one's called The Trespasser. Up she pops again, slim, fresh, beautiful, belonging to no one. Still she swims, now almost unknown in my blood. She is laughing at me, an intoxicating intruder bringing delicious secrets, holding an old deed, a love note, a deed to my heart's true pledge. The past defeating the present, the work of that most beautiful alchemist, the past residing in the present that is the past, all time in retreat and confusion, eating a sumptuous dream of breathtaking power and vision, and the last shall be first, and the first shall be last, and I will slough off the present life like an unsatisfactory skin, and I will disappear like a dream from the mind of a child.
This is a poem from my husband, Jerry, and it's Jerry Jam. This will be the second batch. The first took half the flat I bought from the trunk of a green Buick parked at the South Temple M Street gas station. A week ago, his first attempt turned runny. Now the freezer is prepared to hold more wide mouth jars. Pink spots stain the mushed paper cartons where the berries bled, a few dried dark. I peer inside each berry, expecting beetles, worms, but no. A wash of tart juice leaves just woody seeds between my teeth as Jerry lifts down the white bowl. Here he bravely mashes each tender bit to deep, wet crimson. He adds sugar, replaces the jar with a granular crunch, then syrup, pectin, lifts his nose to peer through reading glasses, unfolded recipe checked. He squats to be eye level with the thick and pulpy surface in the Pyrex cup, then pours. Jerry licks a spoon, shrugs a shoulder. He says this batch is better than the last, lifts his eyebrows wondering which batch to give away.
Strange things happen at Sunstone. This poem happened after Sunstone, after a couple of Sunstones, and it's for our missing poet, Mary Blanchard. She spoke to me in the unnatural radium glow of a hotel lobby late one August night, where the half-life, half-light of our encounter became the luminescent stuff of dream. The beam of shining particles in which our minds arranged themselves was meant for strange attraction, an electron shift, an interaction so mysterious I almost loved the coming dark, when after one embrace she would be gone. Closing my eyes, I sometimes saw her imprint on my lids, ghostly, indistinct. But then my eyes winked open to another August. There in the hot, harsh sun, she was the one I couldn't fathom, tangible and almost painfully alive. Her blue-green eyes deep like the sea, her shirt a metaphorical map of the Southwest, cactus and cattle skulls against a white-hot sky. "Do you mind wet hair?" she said, standing there in the cool doorway of a borrowed house, holding a towel. High on a hill on a street with no name. Did I mind? Did she think I was blind to the way the damp strands clung to her neck? But her eyes framed the question differently. Will you accept my vulnerability? I blink once more. The scene has changed. Another hotel night, another corridor. Our molecules have rearranged. We're every age we've ever been. The fragile child in her is now enfolded by a woman's fierce experience. And in the dark, her dimpled laughter is a spark of fire. But sand is falling in the glass. This tactile moment fades. I lose the now and focus on the when we'll meet again.
I really want to read this.
I think you should. Yeah.
This is, I've been studying Sugar House. I'm so glad that you're here from Sugar House. Sugar House Park, as many of you know, used to be the site of the Utah State Penitentiary. And I ran across an interesting article about a graveyard that was there. After they moved the prisoners to the point of the mountain, they had to come back and move the bodies several years later. So this poem is Moving the Bodies, Sugar House, 1957. They wouldn't use no backhoes. Said they didn't know how far down or how good a shape, so there we was, just that many automatic boots pushing shovels into the grass and down into the mud. Clusters of prison gray working our backs over the ground lower, heaping up some damn good soil, worms, a lady's earring. Kind of joking as we're shoulder deep and swinging shovels past our heads, the guards smoking cools, until one guy, then the next, their shovels hit it and scrape. Some of them coffins was wood and down there easy 50 years. Out of 29, 19 come up real good with just a wedge loose and a rope under. Then up and load 'em, stinking and squeaking on the flatbed. Wave goodbye as they's hauled to the railroad for their new hole at the point. If I had a hat, I would have took it off. Poor suckers can't even get away dead, but get rustled and ousted for swing sets and teeter-totters. Some other of them coffins was crumbly and loose and tilted just enough on getting hauled up to hear this slide like rocks and feathers inside. Jenkins lost it, kneeling at an empty hole. Guard went gray, fighting the urge, stood upwind anyway, to smoke with shaky fingers while the rest of us tied up the box ends tight. One headstone didn't have no body. We dug a hole wide and deep as a swimming pool, looking for ashes, something, but it wasn't nothing there. Looky, guard, a getaway. Made us dig 2 hours more. And riding back, the train bounced all them coffins loose. One even let go a board. And there was something black and hanging like heavy seaweed with fingernails. I saw the guard hold this rag to his face and push the box with his boot. Each rail bump moved over to the side. Then he loosened up the ropes and I never would have thought I'd do a job like that, but face to face with what it looks like after 50 years, the busting up and sprawl of all that's left, I'd sure decide some things a different way. And never let nobody move my body, leastways till I'm straight up, damn sure, through with it.
Yeah. That's a love poem for Sugar House.
Can I just do my other Sugar House poem?
How many Sugar House poems do you have?
Just one more. It's right here.
Then you'll move on to Murray and Midvale.
Where'd it go? Where'd it go?
The description is not a misprint. She loves in Sugar House.
The description in the bio is not a misprint. Pam Bradshaw loves in Sugar House. In fact, I told them that when I brought the copy. I said, don't correct this.
Thanks. This is a poem about the monument in Sugar House, and I'm just curious, has anyone ever seen the monument on 11th East and 21st South? You've seen it? Okay. You touched it. All right, you're in. This is called What Doesn't Go Away. Saturn and his daughter Ceres brace their strong bronze backs against the monument. Between them, granite towers thick into a lanterned pinnacle, and blooms of rose petunias spill at their graceful feet. The vein in Saturn's throat almost pulses with the blood of energy. Smooth muscle holds his skin tight. He pushes one foot slightly forward. The same fine fabric on his lap drapes close around Ceres' perfect breast. She faces east, gathers all her baskets, while he faces west, cradles an ever-pouring urn. They both have excellent posture. Strange doom for goddess of harvest and god of industry. We abandon them to endure long past our lifetimes, press them to a task we wouldn't want. She gathers stillness. He works at never-changing. In hushed whispers around the stone, they notice what is missing, catalog the disappearance of the stream, the fountain, the tracks, the mill, the roundhouse, Smoot's store, and even more, the living flesh of people melting off like party paper in the rain. Both father and daughter tilt their faces to the side as if listening for some weird noise behind. He notices the traffic. She glances off toward the Sprague branch. I think he's just remarked, and she considers her reply, all the while fixing their bronze gaze on something that doesn't go away.
I have no idea at this point. Well, I think I read another cremation poem. I've got a lot of cremation poems.
All right, scramble for your cremation poems.
I pass.
Oh my gosh. I really don't have any sugar house works under in progress. I don't know. I mean, I live there too, but it's only for 3 more weeks. So maybe I ought to move into something I'm familiar with, like mothering and weaning and that sort of thing. I see poems on those things. I have poems for my children in here. I have a poem about the birth of that child, I guess carrying on the theme somewhat. My first birth was at home, and I wish that all of my births could have been like that, because that was for me a magnificent experience, just the way I wanted it. My second birth, I was getting on, and they called me an elderly prima gravida for the first, but for the second, you know, I was borderline. By the third, I was almost 43. And so, of course, I had to have it in a hospital because I was just too decrepit to do any other thing, you know. And so I had this third child in the hospital with a midwife. And what I really wanted to do was have a water birth, you know, in the shore with having my child come from one watery place to another, which seemed to me the most natural. So I wrote a poem about that experience that I didn't have. I call it Water Birth Dream. Do not tell me you emerged in a small papered room, a landscape pulsing red, dop tones pinging walls like fish schooled in a narrow corridor. I will say, I feel your call through a wide, warm strand, nudging upward on the lip where our worlds converge. Hip deep in salty shoals, my open legs incite your path. Tides lick the arc of our shared dome, ebb around my widening thighs. When down through crushing passages and swim free in two silken bursts, you are a small dolphin with deep, familiar eyes scanning another watery hold. A milky, lilting veil, our final separation. As I cradle your head, one small arm, one leg, stretches north, east, summoning me. I raise you to the crack of air. Your gasp takes in the sky, thrums the drum of your heartbeat. You call in your kin. Ringed by their sleek backs, we bob together as a vein of maroon waters recedes out to sea.
Do you have any mothering poems?
No, I'm going to shoot off to the other end of the spectrum of things. Probably one of the things I remember most about, when I was a kid, I remember every Saturday going to the movies, and remember one time my parents sent me down to see some Walt Disney thing, and around the corner was another movie, and it looked more interesting, so I went in to see it. It was a movie called Mein Kampf, which was, kind of on the other end of the thing, and I think I was like 10 or 11 years old or something, and I was wandering to this movie, and it was basically Holocaust footage. And I think some part of me as a child sort of ended right there. And so what happened was, there I was in the audience. I was like, 10, 11 years old or something, looking up and seeing 10, 11-year-old children from the Warsaw Ghetto who basically were murdered by the Nazis and that kind of thing. And it was really such a incredible thing for a kid to see that, see other kids the same age as you and see them looking like really old people and knowing that they had basically probably had some weeks to live and they really didn't know what had happened to them. And it was a horrifying sort of thing. And from time to time I sort of try to write something about it or try to come see if I understand some part of it. And this is what I came up with a while ago. I can only offer you death, he said quickly, looking through me. And I was totally surprised. We had not been told even of the possibility. And he left the room quickly, leaving a guard. I remember he wore brown shoes and wore a brown uniform and had a polished brown leather belt and holster. Brown-handled officer's sidearm, a kind of standard issue, I guess. We heard the shooting start early in the morning, and they say everyone in the village was dead by sundown. The blue smoke from the bulldozers from the night before drifted up towards the moonlight as they worked to finish the pits out there in the woods. I could hear the men laughing. I had never been to those woods before, just trees at the roadside, nothing more. And for months, blood seeped through the soil and colored the water a kind of flesh color, pink. There was such a terrible smell, they should have used quicklime. We live in their homes, eat off their plates, sit in their furniture, and still find gold and hidden family treasures and pictures while repairing the floor.
How do you follow a Holocaust poem? I thought Steve would transist us into something lighter, so I'm going to have to go off some other end, and I'm not sure which end this is off of. Poems happen in all kinds of places. Sometimes poems happen in church. You don't maybe know it at the time, but maybe later. This is a poem called Black Moroni. Painted on the wall behind the seats where a choir sings. See the shining figure in a steep green wood. The angel wears a shirtwaist robe, fabric wing as thin as filament. He looks down slope where Joseph kneels, treasure spread in dirt. Moroni's hair descends his neck in alabaster rolls. His bare feet tread the air above the forest floor. Light he sheds not only notches bark of pine and birch. It breaks the frame, transcends the painting, falls on pews below where angel is made flesh. Curly-headed black child, named Moroni for a prophet in his folks' new church. He's comfortable in cocoa-colored skin. sensual curl of hip and thigh framed to mother's breast. And like another baby born in the meridian of Mormon time, his laugh is whole and unashamed. Lucid eyes obsidian, lashes thick, brows arched high. Something in this black Moroni prophesies of truce between the body and the soul.
Great.
This is Mary Blanchard's poem, Anxiety Dreams. One, I'm locked in a room with no windows. I sit at a desk. On the desk are a piece of paper and a pencil. When I touch the pencil, a loud male voice says, I am not allowed to write any poems until I learn to like computers. Secretly, I'm glad I have never touched a word processor. Two, I tell my friend I want a scooter for my 38th birthday. When I tell her no, not the motorcycle kind, the kind you push with your foot, she looks embarrassed and walks away. Then I'm riding my scooter on the freeway. I am barefoot. Cars speed by. I'm not sure if I'm a woman or a little girl. Secretly, I don't care. Three. I notice my husband talking to a pretty woman at a party. I wasn't invited. I'm across the room. I can't hear what they are saying. I try to call him from a payphone on the wall, but I don't know what number to dial. Secretly, I'm relieved that it's just a dream. Four. Suddenly, it's morning and I haven't slept. I'm standing alone in an empty airplane hangar. It's cold, but I forgot my coat. I'm late for class, which one I don't know. It's the last day, and I haven't read the book. Secretly, you know, there are no dreams in this poem.
Would you like to read something?
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Well,
how much time do we have left?
We got lots of time.
Okay.
How much time do we have left?
45 minutes. Okay, because I want to read two poems, and I want to bring that into the family realm of as in parents, brothers, and sisters. And I have a couple of poems that I've written recently about my family, if I can find them. One is about my brother, and one is about my mother. I do hope I can find them. I just got a phone call from my mother before we came, I mean from my sister, saying that my mother was going in for another round, a third round in a series of radiation therapy. And so I really want to read this poem that I wrote for her about how difficult all of that has been for her to make this transition between being a person who loved to move around on the earth to a person who can't do that anymore and is basically planted in her chair. At least she can sit in her chair. I call this Dancing for Dorothy. On the $5 check she sends to each of my children, which always arrives precisely on their birthday, my mother's handwriting is impeccable. No signs of her 79 years in it. I don't write like an old lady, steady as ever, she declares, proud of the lack of infirmity in her perfect 1920s script, proud to have chauffeured her card-playing pals in her Aerostar van when they shied away from large engines of any sort. She drove herself all over the map, dancing on the wheels of her mobility. My mother refused a wheelchair, or even a cane, when her legs, striate with bone cancer, ground to talc under her. When the distance to the door of anywhere outgrew her shame Dorothy capitulated and hung her cripple card from the rearview mirror, later to stuff it along with fistfuls of change and an emergency torch into the jockey box, locked. Dorothy's hair is jet black now. When I lift a shock of my own, winnowing for the silver strand, only partly for its clash amidst the honey to mouse brown of the rest, a translucent absence of color like the coat of the polar bear. Then I can clearly see Dorothy on the green overstuffed chair in Virginia, shifting with her mirror and tweezers from chin to crown. At some point, risking baldness, she began to pack on the dye, sitting under plastic, her combs and hands stained. Often I have done the dyeing for her, then set the thinning tufts in rows, one hairline to neck, four on the sides, seven between, always the same for decades. Uneasy with change, my mother cannot accept that she has grown old, that her body is riddled with a cancer that will not slip away in miraculous remission. Inside, she is the same girl with stars in her eyes, driving the distance in experimental cars, 90 miles up Spanish Fork Canyon on narrow, single-lane roads that were like impertinent lips jutting from the mountain. With some involuntary will, Dorothy beggared the weekly journey to the dances. It was what moved inside her. Not so much the dancing, but the idea, swishing about under stars to the guidance of strange men, their features illuminated beside shadows of night. One of these shadows, a man whose name I never heard, became the father of my oldest brother. Learning that this mysterious lover was married, unreachable, crushed the dance out of her forever. I never danced with my mother, never saw her dance. Alone I twirl and glide, undulating to the pulse of drums, rhythms nesting deeper than my heartbeat. I will grow old this way, drenching my clothes in this untamed fury, dancing for my mother.
Is it permissible to read something that's not done?
Oh, I don't know.
No.
We better take a vote.
I don't know. Well, maybe this will not make it done.
This is something that I should be reading some scriptural references before I go off on this. You know, this is kind of interesting sort of thing. So if anyone's taking notes, I've got some, like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 scriptures where this is. But I was trying to figure out a good title for this, but I really haven't come up with one yet. But it's, you know. Brothers and sisters, I have an important announcement to make. Is this going to be okay? In last Saturday's Deseret News, the First Presidency proudly announced the return of snake handling as an important and integral part of our Sunday worship service. Beginning next week, an extra half an hour will be added to our meetings to permit a weekly snake handling service. As you know, we are commanded to attend all Sunday services and participate with all our fellow brothers and sisters in this wonderful exercise and test of our individual and collective faith. Brother Olson has volunteered the Boy Scout troop to collect a fine rattler specimens on their next outing next Friday and Saturday. Brother Lindley, please bring back only the finest specimens of our reptilian adversaries. As you must know, recent discoveries have brought to our test the faith of his young Protestant friends whom he suspected of having pickpocketing tendencies.
Well, let's continue in the ridiculous vein for a moment. From the sublime to the ridiculous. When we walked into the room today and I saw there was an overhead projector, I thought it was definitely providential, because I've only written one shape poem in my life, and I had visions I could slap it down on that and record it and put it on the screen. But then, as Pam pointed out to me, you need a transparency in order to do that, and I didn't know if they had that technology available. So I will, like in Sunday school class, I'll have to show you the shape. The name of this poem is Negative Space. This is the key. At the risk of being too obvious. When this group first got together to decide what we were going to do and read poems and see if we were going to bounce off each other and what was going to happen, I nearly fell off my chair at one point because Lynn Osler said this astounding and wonderful thing, which became the first line of the poem. She said, "It's hard being Mormon and having nipples," which hadn't occurred to me, but it's true. There's a certain profound truth in that. Negative space. It's hard being Mormon and having nipples. Having hard nipples. Knowing that they're there under clothing, under garments. One guy at ZCMI had the job, hard job, of sanding off every nipple of all the store's mannequins. Mormon mind thinks of nipples as purely negative space, even male nipples. Poor Tarzan's not so comic strip at the cruel hands of the Des News airbrush censor left the king of the jungle nippleless and, yes, defenseless. Throughout the crazy 50s, in the church Sunday papers, strangely emasculated funnies.
Which Mary poem do you think we ought to do? Roots? Playing Catch? Missing? A Concourse of Devils?
A Concourse of Devils.
Okay. Mary Blanchard. A Concourse of Devils. A concourse of devils wearing party hats. I am asleep and dreaming. Ride steaming dark horses toward me. Slow motion in thundering silence. Fine dust rises in the pallor of moonlight. They come closer, closer. They are upon me. Their stride unbroken, hot foam drips from lips drawn back. Cold white eyes makes me sweat. On they ride in my dreams. Do you like my hat?
Well, I think a request time has come, only because I have a request of my own. Would you read Chain in a Series of Love Dreams?
Okay.
A Pam Bradshaw poem.
Funny, it's right on top. A series in a chain of love dreams. The first one left me desolate. I slammed my car door on his last excuse, but even now the smell of night snow on the slick street brings him back. His shoulders gray against the fast-falling sky, his eyebrows glistening. Once in a while I leave the car door wide to stand out cold and taste the tiny melting drops in his soft mustache. The second one kidnapped me with a heart-shaped box of cheap cream centers. I woke up at Wood Creek, where watercress sponged up the banks and trout dozed in safety. Out there, nature held too many mirrors to allow us good escape, so I took the Stanley turnoff and left his summer straw hat on the gas pump. 9 years ago, my parents said he called to say hello. The third one swore he really left his wife this time. He toured me through his house, opened cabinets, even hung that nude I painted in his hot bedroom. He left me on my birthday, where I cooled on cement steps and swore to never call him. 1 week later, I had missed his funeral. Frantic, I ripped the stack of newsprint to shake the obituary listing his survivors. Mother, wife, two children. The fourth one parked a blue bus in the back. The lawn went to hell. He threw a mattress out there where his boy jumped and screamed, kicking dirty stuffing like rude remarks around my life. I came home with groceries while the man tossed oily tools, bolting mysteries to the belly of the bus. I see him now at parties. His hair hangs gray and a new beard muffles tension in his mouth, but his eyes still fix in that gaze that played the banjo on his bus rolling off to Telluride. The fifth one lives with me in peace. I browse the paper from his chrome and leather chairs. He buys me ceramic angels. In the morning, we drink coffee pre-time to brew as we awaken. Then together, our hands lift ivory mugs as the steam curls up into close hanging light. In the evening, he stirs garlic with exotic vegetables, sizzling reds and greens, while I wash all the sharp knives carefully. We laugh about his ex-wives and the loops of my life closed and hanging like a chain to swing from. At night, his steel arm pins my shoulders to the bed in case I drift away. But if I wake to breathing on my lips, then my eyes, my fingers stay carefully closed. It could be anyone.
Is this the beginning of another round of love poems? Go in any direction you wish.
Okay. This is a love poem called Moosrut. First frost, a thin bright line backlit by early sun rays, limbs the contours of morning, ragged burdock leaves, brittle teasel stalks, the growing cushion of yellow aspen. In this act of awakening, the female moose begins to realize it is her scent the bull is following through the vanishing clouds of her breath. Through the bare bones of trees dressing unprepossessingly in the open, his hooves stomp the flaming bed beneath them. With single-minded intent, he winds toward the ribbon of her pungence. His antlers are bloodied, battering for the chance at her. She is still, as the crack of ramming horns shatters the morning into unrecoverable pieces. Two of them. Disarmed by their nearness, she wanders. They follow, stopping to lock antlers, dance forward and circle, separate and ram again. Her nonchalance is no match for instinct this raw. She does not watch, walks still farther from the sound of impact. Her head will never produce a rack, nor will she grow hungrily after a mate. She wants young, knows only one way to bring the magic inside her. Accepting this, she deems the place where she stands good enough. When the silence finally comes, she waits for him to find her.
For me, I don't have a love poem to read that I can find right off the bat here. If it gets any closer, I'll probably take a bite out of it. Let's see, there's that one. This one's called Frison. There was, there can never be, an untouched, an unanointed part, quiet and still and formless and forming, a heart eternally and irrevocably compromised. Against all scruple, reservation, or law, she has effortlessly triumphed, smiling as she sits, drawing deeply her soft and scented presence from the past, lifting up my weeping face in both hands, collecting my teardrops on a fingertip to hold it directly in front of her face. She looks up, then kisses my face.
all eyes closed, face to face, lip to lip, breast to breast, thigh to thigh, feet tangling, and with a start, a bump, a push, a rhythm starts that will last as long as God.
Poems at hand, I think that one might do. We in this group are part of a writing group, and my attempt at writing poetry came out of this writing group, and pretty amazing sort of synchronicity in the group and in what happens around a kitchen table or sitting in somebody's living room. And this is a poem that grew out of the group, but grew into something else. Could be a new creation myth. I don't know what it is, but I'd be interested in how it hits you. It's called Earth Mother. On creation's morning, Earth Mother put the kettle on, touched each of her literary children seated at the kitchen table, filled their cups with steaming liquid, placed porcelain half moons to receive their bags of tea. Now, she said, as I have given you, please give to me. We'll each create our lives, a girl child said, responsible for all that happens, large or small. Our lives remain a blank until we write them. It won't be God whom we will thank or blame when there's a blot. We'll just rewrite until we get it right. In the beginning was the word, the brash boy said quite cynically. It's sentimental to believe that we can shape our own reality. Under her breath, so only brash boy heard, Earth Mother said, but I created you. And don't you sometimes feel that you created me? And then she poured another cup of tea. Don't great. Everybody jump in at once?
I haven't heard.
Great.
Great.
And the title doesn't really work anymore. I wrote this poem, actually, I forgot where I wrote it, but I remembered after seeing an early version of it that I wrote it on summer solstice in the Deseret Peak. I am a dim crone, my offspring, like stones in a moraine, scree at the mountain crest, the luxuriant nap of timber, obscuring scarp, like the dark velour I wear. I can no longer remember their names. I can only compare. This one is like mimosa, the tree that bordered the garden, another plush as a bumblebee, only lavender and soundless. This blue one is fragile as bells I gathered as a girl following deer along a moldering trail. The flower, the girl, the mountain, I have forgotten all their names. My power is seeping out of me, that gift of hailing each by a bright, precise designation. Now, I only describe how this one has the feel of fine white sands that took me under, drew me out of the antlion's cool lair into the shock of burning air. So, if you belong to me, come close. Let my cheek brush against your temple as it did when you emerged the fragrance of womb lingering in your hair, that sweet scent on the soft, the ark, soft as the yewberry. Set your eye over mine.
I will. I'll take you up on that microphone. This is a poem called Why I Kneel in Kindergarten. In one hand he lifts to the winter sun a crystal finger of ice. Star glints hook our eyes and pull our two heads closer. For a long time we bend unaware of the bouncing, wheeling, sliding, snow-packed playground. Then he lets me hold it. Rolls it from his pink palm onto my black leather and grieves to see that it won't shine for me. A blasting horn revolves the playground outside in, coats on short hooks, boots a rubber jumble, bangs cling to sweaty foreheads like chick down wet from the shell, as children shoulder in to see a sogging paper plate where David holds the melting lump. Already this year, his face has dropped its roundness. His legs don't romp the way they did before I made him sit, legs crossed for too long. But glancing from his narrow gaze is light enough to make the whole world come to him, bright enough to grant his teacher grace. His sober focus draws the others in, offers to each one a closer look at this, his disappearing treasure. I enter on my knees to breach the edge of this small circle, to breathe the holy truth of David's words. There aren't too many of these around.
I want to make a commercial announcement, and then we'll go on, which should have been made at the first, but this session is sponsored by City Art. For those of you who may not know what City Art is, it's the longest-running series of poetry readings in Salt Lake City. It's been going for a lot of years, a lot of dedicated people. Keeping it on track goes way back, and the person that is really... doing it these days is Sandy Anderson, who expected to be here today, but apparently didn't make it. But starting again on September 23rd, which is a Thursday, and continuing throughout the fall, winter, and spring, will be a new round of poetry readings, and they are held these days in a very comfortable place in the basement of the Mount Tabor Lutheran Church. That's the round church on the corner of 2nd South and 7th East. If you like, I'm assuming you like to hear poetry. That's why you're here. Come to those Thursday night readings. They're terrific. Every kind of poet you can imagine, you know, someone from the university followed by a street poet from West 2nd South with an earring in his ear to someone like David Lee, who if you haven't heard him read, is just one of the most incredible readers and writers of poetry in this state. And in fact, the initial program on the 23rd is what is called the Meltdown, and these are poets who performed throughout the year. Last year, 15 to 20 of the audience's favorite poets will be participating on that night. So it'll be something like, you know, today with a few poems from a lot of people. Actually, we got a lot of poems from a few people, sort of the reverse. But anyhow, come. It's a lot of fun, and tell people about it. Okay, well, I'll make a shift again, and yes. Thank you. Thank you for, I didn't say, 7:30. Thank you, Pam. It is. It's 8 o'clock. I think everything starts at 7:30. Yeah, it's 8 o'clock every Thursday night, starting on the 23rd of September. Steve Opager, in the early days of this writing group, in a surge of the kind of imaginative craziness that goes through this kind of a group and usually sort of expresses itself through Steve's mouth. he invented a word that I was so struck by that when he didn't write a poem himself, named that, I appropriated it. And the word he invented is Zerotica, with an X. What could that mean? Well, and every now and again, a poem comes that you have no idea where it came from, what it means, how it came. The only excuse I have is that I liked Steve's word. So this is called Zerotica. I wanted to Xerox her socks off the first time I saw her. Sitting there so primly behind her big blonde walnut desk, she was powerful, capable, and cool. When she stood up to her full 5'10", her necklace, double strands of paper clips, extended well below her hips. And then she spoke with calm authority that seemed to disassemble me. "Go copy these," she said, and handed me a mega stack of documents on double gloss enamel bond, expecting me to reproduce not only what was on the page, but every wrinkle of her agile mind, as if machine were magic wand. I copied, clocked, and collated 1,000 nights for her. The blizzard on her desk was soon so deep, the drifts were like an icon of desire, dazzling, dizzying, dangerously steep. One morning, just at dawn, I found the avalanche was gone. Her huge blonde desk was clear and clean, and where once stood the dread machine, a small credenza and a fountain pen. The cursive of her own fine hand, I noticed then, the note attached by paperclip to something small and bright. "The key is to my desk, in which you'll find a vial of dexedrine. I dream of you at night." She signed it with an X. What? Oh, great.
Sure.
Have you seen this book? Got it? Great. Maybe you like this poem as much as I do. Bereft. The man who lives behind us, whose fence we share, the one whose wife left suddenly last May, has let his fruit trees go, wild and unpruned, heavy with fat, ripe plums and golden apricots that hang way over our side of the fence, reaching arms full and wild with leaves, bent down with so much fruit it spills torn, oozing sweet, onto our lawn. This poem is Liar, Mary Blanchard. I love your lies. They are so transparent and convincing, carefully wrapped, handed to me like a package of hot dogs exposed in neat, obscene, little exhibitionist rows next to the bologna. When I bite... When I bite into one of them, it tastes like beef bouillabaisse, because I know the difference between true lies and lies that are true.
Well, I think I should explain what Zerotica is, for one thing.
Oh,
is anyone interested
in
finding it? Well, we were talking about somebody got fired from a job or something for making some, Xerox copies of some portion of their anatomy on a Xerox machine, and we were trying to figure out there was no word to describe what that was. we figured Zerotica would work. This is a poem kind of inspired by a song. Blues song, and it's the line that kind of kicked it off was, "Look at the sky, don't it make you feel like crying?" Swinging and held snug in a hammock of stars, tiny, shiny dimes, jewelly twinkling, snip snap, celestial circles traced, arced by a child's tiny finger,
back and forth into a state of perfect, gentle grace. It fits together, all these pieces, bread broken and shared at the table in the soft evening light, rough wooden bowls, wooden spoons, wooden mugs filled and steaming. A blackbird of the ocean circles, long, long circles up in the sky. If you know where home is, you know everything.
Anybody have anything to fill it in with? Okay, I'll find the brother poem. This is Paul's request. I lived in Fort Belvoir for several years when I was young, and this grew out of that period. Fort Belvoir, Virginia, an army engineering kind of place. It's called the Other Willie Mays. Maybe some of you know who the original Willie Mays was. I knew another Willie Mays, and you can bet it was baseball we played in the 50s. She wore a white gypsy blouse that cinched right under her blossoming breasts, a band of chocolate belly beneath it. Her tan, she teased. A humor my four black classmates reflected in the weekly stand-up charade performed every week for show and tell. Do your ears hang low, do the wobble to and fro, can you tie them in a knot? You know that one. Almond-colored Willie flaunted dim tan lines from our lingering in the Virginia light, stretching for the flies the older kids popped, drives that always seemed to arc high into the sun, blind us. But we'd stagger sometimes into each other after it. Willie was older than me, came in between Lillian and Chi-Chi. We didn't trouble ourselves with much with the origin. We didn't trouble ourselves much with origin as a band of army brats, where our norm was the peripatetic. She wasn't drawn to the scarlet nail polish my neighbor Barbara brushed on our fingertips, extending our nails, a shot at a Peggy Lee, Linda Darnell, Doris Day kind of show. Willie was brown, her hair in cornrows, and there wasn't much confusion then between dark girls and illusion. The DA hairstyle my sisters swooped up my too young neck inelegantly drooped without the suave gel they insisted I wear. The trend seemed designed for an excuse to swear DA, duck tail, get it? We fell apart unless a lurking adjutant got hip to our artlessness. But Willie swaggered with the luster of her name, and nobody could take that away. Geez, I'd love to catch a fly or two, a whirl on the field now with that Willie girl.
I recently read an incredible book, Meg Wheatley's book, called Leadership and the New Science. It's a book about business, it's a book about science, but it's a book about the way the universe works. What an incredible book. Made me want to write a poem. My sister May wrote a lot of space poems, a lot of science poems. I've never felt I knew anything about science. This book made me feel I could know something. And this is for Mae Wheatley, and the name of the poem is Quantum Theory. Out there, in here, in the universe, matter matters, but maybe not in quite the way we may have thought. Those hottest, farthest stars, these subatomic particles, play games of cosmic tag across vast distances. Sometimes the tail wags the dog. Relationships are everything. We all are players in these silent fields of energy. There are no sidelines in the quantum game. Observe, relate, or spectate is the same. Philosophers who only wish to taste a metaphysical hors d'oeuvre, have stirred the cosmic porridge, changed fate's recipe. Our very being marbles the evolving pattern with a new design. Then space may not be empty. Waves of meaning fill the void and change the face of God. Matter's ID remains unfixed, a packet of potential. It doesn't matter if it's particle or wave or energy. So then are mesons, photons, stars and suns, and you and I all bundled like a book of matches waiting to be struck. Careening universe begins to look more like a thought than a machine.
Since you've mentioned May, I want to read my May Swenson poem. And I think this will be my last poem because we're winding down here. This is called Because I Don't Know, and it's after May Swenson's poem of the same title. Because I don't know you, I love you. Your eyes, direct as desert water, flow from some apparent softness into all of me. Your easy laugh and high cheek glance over your shoulder, your careless thumb hooked in your straight leg stance. I love the way your shoulders hold the fabric of your shirt, the muscles underneath your skin. And when you shake my hand, when you laugh into my shyness and embrace me, I drink the warmth that is your touch. I want to walk upstream. There is something dreamlike in my wondering of you, sensual in rainy light as a Thursday morning nap, waking with my fingers in your hair. But waking is more watery. To grant your woman what it is, hope her fingers button your shirts on their hangers. Hope you both are safe and that you live beyond your limits. Because I don't know you, I can walk, if not upstream, then to the edge of cedar breaks, where I keep the textured rhythm of your voice inside the breeze, the idea of your skin. Perched out above such vast intensity, I memorize your body stretched beside me. I let the sudden canyon gust steal the small white paper from my fingertips, watch its tumbling smaller and smaller below me. Let the canyon hold your name in rock and sand and water. I smell the promise of that water in the desert breeze, and I remember I don't know you, and had better not. Because I don't know you, I love you.
Want to be the holder, huh? Okay, this is one called Traveling Ashes. Please, I ask with tongue planted coldly in cheek, bury me someplace I haven't been lately. In Paris, maybe. Or sift me out of a brown paper bag off the bridge of Montauban on a cold winter morning as the swarms of bicycles quickly pass. Or leave me with the discarded Coke cups in the wastebasket in the record and tape department of the Payless drugstore in Salem, Oregon. Preferentially, I lean towards being sprinkled out onto the outgoing evening tide in Neskowin on a warm August night, weighed out and set me adrift, trailing, eddying out and around, spreading through the kelp beds, a molecule at a time, bon voyage. As the quarter moon, a shimmering ancient golden crescent set deep in a blue-black sky, looks away.
I looked. I know it's in here. Yeah. I guess the reason that I don't have a lot of funny
poems is that I knew that I'd be here with Pam and Steve, you know, and that they could hold that end up for me. I do have one about being a hag, which is pretty funny and just all too dang real to read. Oh, here it is. No, there it isn't.
There it is.
Okay, so it isn't very pretty, this poem. It's about what I consider one of my best moments of rescuing my brother as a child, and he was about 2 or 3, and I was about 5 or something. But it didn't come through that way for my mother. I call it rescuing Butch. With my toes wedged into a flute of the spiraling metal culvert, my pink striped sundress around my waist, legs pressed into the dirt road, I am searching in the dark cylinder for him. Water is moving too fast. My brother is in there, inside the culvert, mosses and sticks draggling along with him, stuck now. My little brother lodged under the road in a place too small for him, too small for me. I scream. He swallows a scream. I had held his hands, first two, then one flimsy clutch on his life before he went under, praying, God, don't let him slip. But his grip was weak, mine weak. Mommy! I bellow into the void, hear the screen burst open, her angry words forbidden list around my ears. I don't know what to fear most, my soggy brother or her rage, a terror that will rest on me. I jump down in front of the culvert's mouth, my small body, an uncertain strength against the flow of the ditch, holding back its rush. I struggle aside. It works. My 2-year-old brother flushes out the end like a bundle of seaweed deposited at the feet of my mother. One scuff dangling from her toes, the heel trailing a slender ribbon of blood, the mark of a tormented scramble across pebbles and dirt that threw up balloons of dust under her feet. The moment she can see that her son is intact, emollient and gasping, yet propped in his familiar niche on her right hip, my mother removes her overburdened slipper and cracks her terror across my back, my shoulder, my cheek. I'm only 5. I do not understand her need to launch this fury on me, the impulse to punish until the panic resides. I figured I'd saved him. Thought he might not have been spit out if I hadn't jumped into the water. I didn't dare consider that she held me responsible, needed someone hanging like a dusty rug to beat, because the blood on her feet, their scars, had long since thrashed her own heart to ash. I was much, much older before I understood.
Before she can assume her identity, we must lose our preconceptions of prophets. She cannot be found in the Book of Mormon, where there was no room for her, but she will make room for herself in the hearts of her people. She will wear a t-shirt, jeans, and boots, and in a little pouch around her neck carry polished stones. When she shows up at her home ward, she will not be recognized as anyone unusual, nor will she be asked to be a visiting teacher, but someone will later remember that at a ward dinner she asked for a second helping of lime jello, after which she excused herself and left the cultural hall. Apocryphal stories will insist that as a young woman she attended a rock concert in a meadow ringed by a racetrack near Springville, Utah, where she boarded a banned bus to calm a drunken Commander Cody. then mesmerized his musicians by speaking to them in tongues, one of her disciples will claim that he regained his sight by returning to that meadow to submerge in a polluted stream. Thought I might have encountered her myself at 7-Eleven, crying softly at the curb, wearing the requisite jeans and drinking from a 2-quart bottle of Fisher beer. Accepted the hug I gave her and the coffee I bought her in a big gulp cup. "My name is Debbie," she said. "You came here for a reason." 3 hours later, a woman in a white, long white dress and dark glasses appeared at my ward house, but I failed to recognize her. I have observed other signs of her coming. The woman who cut my hair in a $3 shop across from Banbury Cross Donuts told me she had birthed a miracle baby who would have died if not for the vision she had witnessed during labor when she entered the long dark tunnel of her own vagina and saw the umbilical cord wrapped around her daughter's neck, warned the doctor who untangled the cord, saved the baby. But she had seen it first from the inside. She will not be found at the genealogical library, but someone will say they saw her buying used paperbacks at DI. It will be noticed there is no garment line under her t-shirt, but she will blur the line between spiritual and sensual. She will introduce the sons of men to the moon circle and the daughters of women to Iron John. In her cellar is a 2-year supply of love. The prophet Debbie is awaiting her call, and I am waiting also. Do you want to ask us any questions? Do you want to throw tomatoes? What do you want to do?
Well, I think you've heard of speaking in tongues today.
For those of you who don't know, William Mulder of the University of Utah, one of my idols, to have him come today means a lot. And thank you, Marty Bradley, for coming, the co-editor of Dialogue. Why don't we all introduce ourselves? Who are you people?
That'd be great.
I have a poem about that woman.
Really?
Yes.
Well, it's about time. See? We all know each other. Anybody else want to say anything? Thank you for coming today. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks.